Our next panel is the regulator panel, entitled Ask Me Anything on FX. Our first guest is Dr. Chris Kent, Assistant Governor of Financial Markets of the RBA and Chair of the Australian Foreign Exchange Committee. He's responsible for the oversight of the bank's operations in the domestic and global financial markets, including the management of Australia's foreign reserves. He briefs the RBA board on developments in financial markets at the monthly board meetings and participates as the bank's representative on the BIS Markets Committee and the BIS Committee on Global Financial Stability. Please give him a round of welcome. Our second guest is Calissa Aldrich, Senior Executive Leader for the Market Supervision at ASIC, where her team is responsible for the real-time surveillance and monitoring of trading activities across Australia's equities, futures and OTC markets. The team is also responsible for market intermediaries' compliance and conduct and monitoring the distribution of complex products. Before joining ASIC, she was at RBS in London. She was also with the UK Financial Services Authority, now known as the FCA, worked at Market and Australian Treasury. We please welcome Calissa Aldrich. Chris, I thought we might start with just an overview of where the RBA sits at the moment in terms of what they're doing in FX markets, how they see the global outlook, how they see the outlook for the Australian dollar, and what you're up to at the bank.
Well, I think I echo Dr. Houston's remarks on the Aussie dollar. We're not in the business of predicting it. I'm not going to go there. I have nothing to offer in that regard other than be careful if you are in the business of predicting the exchange rate. I'm not sure I want to say a lot about the global outlook. I mean, our forecasts were for global growth to slow, but to slow from an above average to something around average. And I think it's still a question of watch this space. Data's been a little bit weaker in patches, but it's in patches since then. And we've also seen that the Fed sort of pull back on their monetary policy path. The dots have been revised down, and then China's providing a bit more stimulus. So maybe I won't say much more than that.
Calissa, I think everyone's aware that ASIC is getting very much involved with OTC markets, in particular foreign exchange market. Can you tell me where ASIC is at in terms of their, overview of FX markets?
Yeah, sure. So wholesale and retail OTC markets are key priorities for us. They have been for the last few years and they continue to be. We're particularly interested in the conduct controls that firms have in place, and we really still see that the controls are less mature in the OTC markets than they are in other regulated markets, and that really needs to change. And commensurate, I think, with some of those risks, we're really increasing our capability in terms of number of staff, our systems and our data to continue to monitor this market. We're obviously in a period of time where the industry is going through substantial remediation following some significant conduct issues in FX markets. We have a number of court enforceable undertakings with firms to manage that remediation and ensure that there's appropriate conduct going forward. We're enhancing our approach to supervision, so a number of you in the room have probably had the pleasure of us or the team doing some on-site inspections with a focus on FX at the moment. Really following through from those enforcement investigations are themes around conflicts of interest and managing confidential client information, and they're the themes of the on-sites that we're pursuing at the moment. We've also been focusing quite closely on markups and pre-hedging, and we're looking at releasing to those firms who've been part of that review a summary on the findings there. And again, I think it goes back to the initial point about that some of the controls not being as mature in this space as in some of the more regulated markets in terms of surveillance, record keeping, engagement with clients and controls around those client agreements. We also continue to have a keen interest in what's happening in Last Look, and we've done some work here and we plan to do some more work in the year ahead. And I think the key message here is, based on our discussions with buy side and other clients, corporates, etc., there's not a great understanding of what's happening in this space, and we really encourage all clients to really make sure they understand what the practices are and what the outcomes might be for them in terms of pricing outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd like to talk about the FX Global Code for a minute. There's been a great enthusiastic response from the sell side in adopting the code, with statements of commitments that are now being registered on all the public registers around the world. I think there's more than 800 statements of commitment that have now been published. But the take-up on the buy side has been, let's say, fairly lackluster. Chris, what do you think, or why do you think there's such a reluctance from buy-side institutions to sign statements of commitment to the code?
Well, I think maybe, you know, I think there are some buy-side participants who have signed up, but you're definitely right. It's less than on the sell side. I think perhaps for some, there's a sense that maybe the code doesn't apply to them. Maybe they also overestimate the cost of making a commitment. I think they perhaps believe also that the improper practices that have occurred around the world in this space have really only been coming from the sell side, and therefore, again, it doesn't apply to them. But I think while not all of the principles of the code, and the code is very much a principles-based code, it's not a rules-based one. The principles, not all of them apply to the buy side. And so I think there are a range of principles that do apply to market participants, but the code is intended to be used proportionately to your business. And so if you're on the buy side, there are a smaller set of principles that you really have to adhere to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope that the buy side can increasingly recognise the benefit of the code. I think the other thing I'd just point out that is true is that for those in the audience, particularly from the buy side, I'd put to you the following question. I'd ask you how you justify to your stakeholders, so they might be people, investors if you're a fund manager, they might be your shareholder if you're in a corporate business. I'd ask you to think about how you justify to them why you haven't adopted a set of principles which represent industry best practice when you're managing their money. So I think there's a prospect that with that perspective, and if we can get that message out there, mm-hmm. there'll be more buy-side take-up.
Calista, from your perspective, or from ASIC's perspective, I should say, do you think it's a requirement that all participants should be signing a statement of commitment?
Oh, look, I don't think we can say it's a requirement because it is a voluntary code. The way we look at it is we already have requirements embedded in law and very high-level principles embedded in law around conflicts of interest and the rest of it. And when you look at the code, to me, a lot of what the code is trying to achieve is to really break down some of those conflicts and provide examples of how you might manage those conflicts and to get some international consistency. And I think my view is arguably that actually the code is already a legal requirement because of the requirements, the overarching requirements that both buy-side and sell-side need to adhere to under the Corporations Act.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Chris, I know that you've done a lot of work with the GFXC. In fact, you're the central bank representative from Australia on the GFXC. How do you think the GFXC could improve its communication with market participants, just in regarding changes and amendments to the code?
Well, I think the first thing is to stress that those sort of changes and amendments are likely to come gradually. So there's a process of communication. The sorts of things you imagine are events like this happening around the world, whereby people like myself and others quite familiar and central to the code are sort of promoting anything of real substance. Of course, if there were changes in the code, we would do our utmost to publicise them. They'll be available for all to see, including, I think, through existing members who've already signed up, would be paying a lot of attention to those and would have provided a lot of feedback already that led to any changes. You know, the code's been out for a little while now. We're set to do a review fairly regularly, but not that regularly, in a wholesale fashion. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what comes in a year or so when that happens.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the audience on the global code at all for either the RBA or ASIC? All right, we do have a question coming up from Slido for Calista. What has ASIC done with the derivatives transaction reporting? What risk and market trend indication has ASIC drawn from the data collected?
So we've increasing the amount of resources that we focus on this OTC data. There's a real challenge in using it, so there's some data quality issues that we're working through. There are different standards in data that are coming through from different repositories. But we really are starting to get to the point where the data is being integrated into our everyday surveillance processes, both in the fixed space but also in the equity derivative space. And While it doesn't process through the systems in the same way as the real-time equity surveillance data does, for example, that comes straight through from the exchange, when we see suspicious conduct or we have concerns about different movements in the market, we absolutely draw on that data to help inform what's going on and to lead the questioning that we have with firms. So I think what I would say here is this is an increasing area of focus for us. We're investing in the technology and in improving the quality of that data, and in time we'll have far more sophisticated analytics that run across it. But at the moment it's an important source to inform our surveillance.
Thank you. Turning to an event that happened earlier this year on the 2nd of January, where we saw the yen surge by 4% against US and as much as 7% against the Aussie. It's not the first time we've seen what are now dubbed as flash crashes. Obviously, it didn't just affect the Aussie and the US too. There were a number of currencies that also were affected. And of course, we saw the yen bounce back or fall back fairly dramatically not long after that. Chris, from your research at the RBA or from the talks and discussions you've had with market participants, what do you think of the drivers of those market movements were?
So I think the first thing is it's hard to be know for sure. Having said that, I think what most people I think would acknowledge is that there was a pretty broad-based deterioration in risk sentiment sort of starting around the turn of the year, but it picked up a bit further on the 3rd of January when Apple came out with a downgrade to their revenue, and they were pointing to concerns about the Chinese demand for their product. That promoted a Japanese appreciation against the US dollar, and then also set off eventually a disorderly depreciation of the other yen crosses, including the Aussie yen. I think there were some factors that were working to amplify this event, those initial moves. I think the first was, I think it's fairly widely acknowledged, there's a heavy presence of Japanese retail investment in a number of the currencies that faced a significant depreciation. Mm-hmm. And what those retail investors were facing once those initial moves started was some automatic liquidation stops on their positions. Now, that's driven by Japanese regulation, and it's an attempt to limit losses and excessive speculation and protect those retail investors from even larger losses. But those sort of liquidation stops probably kicked in, and they kicked in at a time of day and a time of year when volumes were very low. Mm. So it was between the close of the US markets and the normal opening of the Tokyo markets. Tokyo wasn't open, it was a public holiday. And it was also summer holidays here. So arguably trading here, even though we were open, was a bit thin. And then finally, maybe we don't really know, but maybe some algorithmic trading strategies played a bit of a role, where they were switching off in response to these large movements to protect themselves.
Yes, I think algorithmic traders tend to bear the brunt of the blame for many of these flash crashes. Given the rise of algorithmic trading and quant trading, Calissa, do you think we should expect more of these crashes in the future?
Look, I think given the global nature of markets, the fragmentation and increasing automation, I think we should expect that there will be these types of crashes in all markets. And what's really important is that firms are preparing themselves to have adequate systems and controls to respond, to be prepared to deal with extreme price movements. These have real consequences through to not just the wholesale markets, but to retail markets. And it's important that we look at some of those controls for retail investors too.
And Chris, what do you think market participants can do to better protect themselves against these type of crashes?
Well, I think just an awareness that they exist is the starting point. I mean, in some ways, there's a potential for market responses to help mitigate these sort of risks. If you're attentive to these possibilities, one, we talked a bit about maybe some of their algorithms turning off, reducing a bit of what was perceived to be liquidity and reducing liquidity further, possibly amplifying these things. Well, it's a possibility that in time people develop trading strategies, including algorithmic ones, which look for these large moves and see them as profitable opportunities. And if that happens, you can have the market get itself to a place where it works to mitigate some of these extreme movements. I mean, we know that you can make profits when things move a lot. Mm-hmm. So that's a possibility. I wouldn't I wouldn't like to see us in a situation where people just say anytime these large market moves occur, we're just going to pull all our trading and stop, because that will just work to amplify these sorts of things.
Chris mentioned before, retail investors in Japan obviously are getting stopped out, but obviously that triggered a lot of stop losses for Australian investors as well, any retail investor. Is ASIC looking at better protecting retail investors in these types of markets?
Yeah, I mean, we've been looking at the impact of stop loss orders across all markets over a number of years and over different times engaged in consumer warning campaigns about the risk of having those stop loss orders and speaking to your broker about how you might manage those. We've also, within the international context, been engaging with IOSCO, which is the International Committee of Securities Regulators, on a range of controls and principles to help address some of the issues we see in the retail OTC market. And one of those is negative protection, negative balance protection, which essentially is a recommendation that issuers should be offering the protection so investors can't lose more than they were initially invested. So even though in these events, there is a possibility of investors losing all of their money, at least they can manage that downside risk, which we think is really important. But investors need to understand that stop loss orders do put them at risk when there are these price movements, and they need to be prepared to take the consequences in terms of the ultimate price outcome when those orders are triggered. We have exactly the same discussion in other markets after flash crashes in the equity markets, for example, the same messaging. And it's a mix of controls, but we also expect their brokers to have controls in place to help protect them, and of course have adequate margin to cover those losses.
Sure. Don't forget, you can ask questions at any time if you want to put your hand up. It seems that most people would choose to remain anonymous at the moment. This one is also for Calissa. Any plans, this is from the Slido, of course, any plans to make FX a key financial benchmark rate to be regulated by ASIC in the future?
So I don't have a. I think the answer is no at this stage. So we're still considering the range of benchmarks. Obviously, there are some benchmarks. We're going through a process of treating them as benchmarks that need to be formally administered and the administrators licensed. But at this stage, we haven't looked forward at all the range of benchmarks. I can't see that the rate is going to be one that we would look to license. But I can't give you a definitive answer on that.
All right. Chris, I think this one is for you, also from Slido. How's the IBOR reform going to impact your policy direction? Not quite FX. Well, there is obviously a link to FX there.
Well, actually, I was asked this a little while ago in a slightly different context, but my answer was I can't imagine it would, other than indirectly, to the extent that it does create financial stresses and problems. But other than that, I don't see that the IBOR reform has any implications for the cash rate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Calissa, in mid-2018, ASIC outlined its concerns about certain practices in retail OTC derivatives, which failed to meet expectations, and in particular, they were concerned about misleading market materials, unclear pricing methodologies, inadequate risk management practices, inadequate monitoring of counterparties, and inappropriate referral arrangements. What is ASIC doing at the moment to act on those concerns?
We're really active in this space at the moment, actually, and these products are highly risky. We're seeing lots of examples of retail investors losing significant sums of money, and we're really trying to target on a range of fronts. So we're looking at poor conduct, we're looking at the products themselves, and what are the attributes of the product that are leading to losses, so for example, excessive leverage, and really working with them firms to raise standards. So in terms of some of the outcomes, we've had quite an extensive consumer warning campaign about binary options and likening those products to gambling products. And if you look at the demographics of the key investors in that space, typically males in their 20s, but of course investors of all various demographics. So that campaign was managed through social media. We've been working with Apple and Google and increasingly other platform providers who were making binary option apps available to retail investors, and where they're unlicensed, to have those apps removed. We've been very active in the enforcement space. We've cancelled licence, we've suspended licences, we've banned individuals In terms of misleading statements, we've been active in having a number of those websites remove that misleading information. We're increasingly seeing false client testimonials, and we've been effective in having those removed as well. I mentioned before the IOSCO work, the international work, which we've been actively engaged in and very much support those principles that have come out. The next phase really for us is to think about how to apply those principles domestically in Australia, so that's something we'll seek to consult on in this calendar year. So it's been a very proactive area for us. We're very closely engaged with our enforcement department and we're really getting some positive outcomes, but at the moment it is very much whack-a-mole. We don't have a power at the moment to ban these products outright.
Sure. I guess one of the major concerns about these OTC derivative products for retail investors is the amount of leverage that they can get. And this next question from Slido addresses that. It says, what's ASIC's attitude towards limiting leverage in retail FX given the global regulatory changes in Europe last year?
So we don't have the power yet, but we're very excited that there is a bill in Parliament on product intervention. And when that comes through, and we're obviously preparing for that power to come through, we're seriously considering the attributes of these products and at what level we see the most significant harm. So you're right, other regulators, not just in Europe but in North America, parts of Asia, do have limits on CFDs and other leverage products. Margin FX is a key product that where there is limits. And we're looking at that, and as soon as that power comes through, I think you should expect that there will be a consultation from us. I think what we're seeing in terms of leverage, routinely seeing 500-to-1 leverage, essentially you can invest $2,000 and have $1 million exposure. I mean, for retail investors, unsophisticated retail investors, that is a ridiculous amount of exposure for mum and dad investors to have access to.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of which, the government's introduced legislation to increase ASIC's intervention powers. They're coming, obviously, the election is proving difficult to get other stuff through that we want at the moment. But what are the scope of the powers that ASIC is looking for in terms of those interventions?
So the powers based as they're drafted at the moment are quite broad-ranging. They enable us, subject to consulting with the industry and demonstrating that there is significant detriment to consumers, to either put in place some attributes about products to address that harm, so in the context of leverage, the possibility of capping leverage right through to banning. And so in other jurisdictions, there are many jurisdictions actually that have gone down the path of banning binary options, for example, and all of those options will be available to us when the power comes through, subject to executing the power in an appropriate way, including consulting and taking account of the impacts of that power.
And is that in line with the FCA and ESMA when the temporary ban and permanent ban on binary options? That's what ASIC's looking to achieve as well?
Well, we need to consider that and consult on it, but there's certainly options that we're looking at, and we're working very closely with international regulators to understand what the implications of introducing those controls have been.
Sure. So we've spoken about OTC FX derivatives. What other products are in scope for those powers?
So the powers will be broad-ranging for most of the products that ASIC oversees, from securities, derivatives, managed investment schemes, credit products, super products, mortgage products, leases. All of those products are potentially in scope, but of course the duty on ASIC is to demonstrate that there has been significant detriment to consumers, or that there is a risk of significant detriment, and it doesn't, just by having the power doesn't necessarily mean we'll be in a position of wanting to implement the power across the board. I think it really, especially when you go down the path of banning, that really is the path of last resort. It shouldn't be, it really should be used after all other tools have been exhausted. And I think what we would say is we've been very active in supervising this space. I think we've achieved some fantastic outcomes, but it very much is a whack-a-mole approach, and we continue to see the same harms and new players entering the market. And that's exactly the circumstances, I think, that the power is designed to address.
Sure. Both the RBA and ASIC, of course, are members of the Council of Financial Regulators, which includes Australian Treasury and APRA. Has there been any sort of coordinated... Because maybe you can tell us a little bit about the coordination you have with other regulators in addressing market supervisory powers, or what you look at in terms of FX markets?
I think in the FX market, I wouldn't say that the CFR has played much of a role, but ASIC and the bank, of course, are consult closely, and we helpfully have ASIC come along to, as you'd know, to some of our AFXC meetings where we discuss sort of the developments that they're pursuing. We have the capacity there to raise our own concerns, and some of them Chris has already sort of touched on with regards to sort of protections for retail investors in some of the products, mm-hmm. where our own members of the AFXC have sort of seen these concerns and worry about them. So that's a sort of a useful forum, but we also have close contact with ASIC more generally, but not so much in the FX space through the council.
Sure.
A lot of our engagement with other regulators is exactly as Chris has outlined. We haven't had extensive discussions on retail OTC derivative reform through COFA, but obviously engaging very closely with Treasury, which is the agency which is responsible for, you know, just working on the bill and with government to have that bill come through. And we will continue to engage with Treasury, RBA, and the industry to really understand the extent of the harms and where we need to intervene to address those harms.
One of the things that came out of the Royal Commission was, of course, was getting the ACCC involved in more market regulation. Do you see that they have a role to play in FX markets?
I don't. I can't really comment on that. I don't have a view either way.
I think the same view from ASIC at this stage. We need to see where the key competition issues are and engage ACCC, which we do in any event, even though we haven't had a competition mandate up until now. Mm-hmm. We actively engage ACCC on any matters where we see that there are significant competition issues.
Yeah. I mean, in the wholesale space, it's not clear that competition is really an issue that warrants attention in the FX world.
Mm. All right. Are there any further questions, either from the floor or for Slido?
Yeah, hi there. Just a quick question regarding RG97 for transaction cost reporting. I just wanted to understand, obviously there's through consultation papers, etc., continually the conversation's going, but I'm just thinking in the context of comparison to a MiFID II, where you're sort of talking about best execution and you're proving best execution in a certain way of how you're actually going about your transaction costs, especially in, say, for example, FX hedging. Do you feel that the requirement of RG97 is creating a bit of a divide in the context of proving that best execution when it just comes down to a solitary number?
So I have to say this is an area of responsibility that I have at ASIC. What I would say is best execution is obviously a really important principle, and irrespective of what mechanism we're using to require that MTDs are adhering to best execution, it is a really important principle. We do have quite a different model from what you have within Europe, obviously. So Europe MiFID requires a very broad-ranging best execution requirement across a broad range of investment firms and a broader range of products than potentially we have here in Australia.
All right, second question was over there.
Hi, my name is Darius Petrak. I have a question about, there are still some FX brokers in Australia which are going into liquidation because they are commingling money of the clients with their company money. Is it a growing trend, and what ASIC is doing to protect this area?
Sorry, can I just clarify the question? You're suggesting that they're using client money?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so something
I can name the companies if you like. But
I'm probably quite aware of some of the companies that you're talking about. So something that ASIC had been pursuing for a number of years and which was implemented last year is client money reform in the retail OTC derivative space. And this puts limitations on when firms are able to use client money for their own purposes. So, for example, for hedging and so forth. And firms are now required to report client money through to ASIC. What we do see, though, is that this is still a sector that is that has very variable conduct, and there are a number of cases that ASIC is in the process of pursuing through enforcement outcomes, and some of those outcomes are public where those funds have been used by the company, and we take that conduct very seriously, and by virtue of the fact they've been referred through to enforcement, and we're throwing the full book of law behind those cases to show you the seriousness that we place on firms using client money in that way.
The last question is a fairly broad one. It's actually asked, are there any parts of the FX market that are not regulated? The question actually asks, is a particular company regulated? I'm not going to mention that company. But are there any aspects of the market that you feel that are not within your remit?
So I go first in focusing on. So internationally, there's a key challenge here. We do have providers who seek to offer services in Australia who are based offshore, who ought to be licensed or aren't licensed. I think that's the key issue about, not so much about the regulatory reach, but providers who are coming here and operating unlicensed. And that's a really big challenge for us and something that we need to continue to pursue. I wouldn't say at this stage that there's specific areas of the market that we feel as though we don't have regulatory reach. We have broader regulatory reach than most other conduct regulators. You might need to... Do you want me to repeat part of that?
Yeah, just
what
the last
I was saying is I think the biggest issue is unlicensed providers operating in Australia, and it's quite a difficult challenge to deal with those entities, although we have had some successful outcomes. And I think comparing our regulatory reach in Australia, certainly as a conduct regulator, we've got broader reach than some other regulators in terms of capturing spot effects, for example. There are other regulators that don't capture that as part of the conduct regulation. So I can't identify any sort of key areas where we feel as though we don't have the reach that we need.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think it's about time that we took a break for coffee. Will you please thank our panellists this morning, Chris Kent and Calissa Aldridge.